Welcome, Internations, to the 44th crisis in the ongoing catastrophe the authorities call Spider on the Web, an athletically user-supported podcast brought to you, like its predecessors, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial. Actually, most doctors now agree the podcast is useful only in those rare cases where the penis is actually fractured. I'm going to open this week with a taste of one of my favorite singers and keyboardists and arrangers and songwriters in the world, Mr. Georgie Fame. Unfortunately, repeated requests to him via his website for permission to podcast him have so far brought no reply, even though I attached the text of the entire chapter of my book, The Crazy Years, devoted to how much and why I love Georgie Fame. So, to cover my own arse, I must bring you excerpts only. But they're excerpts of some of my very favorite tracks, which I hope you will seek out in full on their CDs after you've heard them. The CDs in question are a matched pair, Name Droppin' and Walking Wounded. Together they document what sounds like it must have been the perfect set. Here are a couple of excerpts. First, The Eros Hotel, thanks to which I ended up being friends with the great American singer-songwriter Daryl Scott, but that's another story. Here's this one, The Eros Hotel.
This song comes from a poem by Fran Landesman. It is called The Eros Hotel. Rainy day in London, I sauntered down to Soho. Dropped into the French pub for a look. Ran into a new face, seemed like something special. Arm in arm to Foster by book. Now we're strolling up Shaftesbury Avenue. And there's only one logical thing to do. Let's go up to the Eros Hotel and write some love songs on the sheets. We'll climb the dusty carpet stairs. The smell of hurried love affairs. Old victories and defeats. There's a bar in the Eros Hotel. It's like a party all the time. That's where you meet the unicorn. Young man with the golden horn. They all know how to rhyme. I've never been alone with you. I don't know how good we could be. And if we should collaborate, music of you fit the lyric of me. So let's go up to the Eros Hotel. I'll write some love songs on the sheet. The sheets are worn as soft as sin from all the loves that might have been. The sweet sonatas of the skin of dawn at the Eros Hotel. Thank you.
All right, that was from Walking Wounded, which is the name of the band. This one is from Name Droppin', another Georgie Fame original, Cool Cat.
It's a sad, sad, very sorry case of love. I never thought I'd be counting sheep, losing sleep and all that. I thought I was a real cool cat, in fact. Never thought I'd be starry-eyed. You know I can't decide where I'm at. I thought I was a much cooler cat than that. You put me down, 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 like I wasn't even there.
Woo! What a clown.
You made me look so square. Thought I'd be hurt by you, but guess who hit the man? Girl, I thought I was some kind of acrobatic cat, so I called Clark Terry. I said, Clark, get me out of that.
If you Google my name and Georgie Fame's together, you can probably locate on the internet somewhere the essay that I wrote about him some time back and published in my collection of essays, The Crazy Years. Check that out. But meanwhile, I urge you to go over to I'm going to actually spell this out here. It's /dp/b00000j aq0/req=sr_1_1 question mark ie=capital UTF-8 ampersand s=music ampersand qid=1211540169 0 ampersand sr=1. That's the end of the URL. If you type all that shit in there, or if you just go to Amazon.com and ask not for Walking Wounded. Apparently some more modern bunch of idiots have appropriated that name more recently. Try Name Droppin', and you should be directed to both CDs, which I recommend you buy as a pair. They just belong together. On that particular webpage, you'll find my review of the album. And now it's time to make one of those very hard choices and stop playing you Georgie Fame for a while I read to you from Very Hard Choices, my new hardcover novel coming out from Bain Books, well, just about any time now. Better bookstores should already have copies sneaking out on the shelves as we speak. When we left our friend Russell last week, he was literally up a creek with no paddle, the creek in question being Howe Sound. He was in one of them inflatable rubber boat thingies with a motor strapped to the back. which one of its owners refers to as the Killer Zodiac and the other simply calls the Fiendish Dinghy. Russell, need it be said, is a landlubber. We begin. The first half of the voyage wasn't too bad. The seating was comfortable enough once I got the damn cell phone out of my hip pocket and into my shirt pocket. Despite the overcast and the smutch, there was enough light left to see where I was going. Although Lena had been right about the wind and tide, the dinghy's little motor was up to them. It sounded like a sewing machine having hysterics, but it performed more like a big chainsaw. The direction of the waves was such that by diverging only slightly from a head-on course, I could approach Coveney Island. I thought at the time I was miserable, but in retrospect I was just uncomfortable, apprehensive, and heartsick. If I'd been miserable, I wouldn't have had attention to spare to beat myself up for having somehow dragged my son, my only remaining piece of Susan, into deadly peril. I'd awakened that morning hoping today would be the day I'd finally manage to bury the hatchet with Jesse, so Susan could finally get on with the resting in peace part of her afterlife. Instead, we both had a fair chance of joining her, thanks to an old mess of mine I'd failed to clean up. Good one, Dad. Fortunately, after perhaps half an hour of that, I was distracted by the rapid onset of mortal terror, followed almost at once by incredible peril. It began with the idle observation that the rain seemed to be picking back up again. Very fast. Then the wind did, too. Hard. Then the waves did, too. Big. That quickly I was in hell. It was dark and windy and cold and noisy and active out there. The rain came down so hard it felt like a vibrator was strapped to my skull. It became a good idea to do a bit of bailing now and again with the hand I wasn't using to steer. Never in my life have I been more grateful that I don't get seasick. I grew up riding subways and the Coney Island roller coaster. Then the damn water began to cheat. The direction of the waves changed. To keep making for Coveney, I had to go at an ever-increasing angle from perpendicular to them. A point was going to come when I'd have to steer away from my destination to keep from being flipped, swamped, or both. After hard thought, I decided when that point came, my move was to turn counterintuitively, in what felt like the wrong direction, but somehow looked right. I'd be moving away from Coveney then, but at least I wouldn't drift past the bastard. Past it was nothing but a whole lot of the Strait of Georgia. I could just make out the lights of Nanaimo over on the horizon, but the bulk of Vancouver Island itself was too far to make out in this light. Each time I ran the problem, I got the same answer. As the angle changed, I began to get a stiff neck from keeping both my eye on the prize and my hand on the tiller. The decision point came. I squinted at my cards one last time, put my money on the table, hauled on the tiller, and waited to see what nature had. I came about fast and was once again perpendicular to the waves. I stopped approaching Coveney, but I stopped sliding past it, too. I started to gain ground a little. I hadn't fucked up. I began to envision a point at which I would be able to do a quick 180 and almost coast to Coveney. Call me Ishmael, predecessor of email. That raised the question I'd been postponing. Just exactly what the hell was I going to do when I got there? The first reason Little Coveney Island is a terrific place for a man in Zooty's predicament to live is there's no good place to land. The second reason is there aren't even any mediocre ones. There are only one or two even rotten ones charted with warnings in boldface. Ugly rocks laid out like a driver-ed obstacle course. Completely invisible rocks in no pattern at all. Crashing surf with an occasional geyser like a sounding whale. Whirlpools. Randomly reversing currents. Enough rusting pieces of ex-ships to qualify as Davy Jones's dumpster. Even horny teenagers on drugs don't try to land on Coveney. There are better places closer. I think Keith could have done it. Lena would probably never have tried. I told myself I'd think of something once I got a closer look. Hell, I'd figured out that I needed to go the wrong way, hadn't I? There'd been a time when Columbus was the only guy on Earth that smart. How hard could it be to park? No wonder the boat was barking like an applauding seal and shaking my hand. It was barking like a seal? I spun around. A similar sound can be made by inhaling sharply while saying the word we repeatedly. What was producing it now was the motor mount tearing itself free of the fiendish dinghy. No, the Killer Zodiac. All rubber breaks down if you leave it out in the sun for enough years, and the first warning is usually failure. A visible gap widened with each whee as the motor tried to deny our inevitable parting. It wasn't because I'm stupid, really. It was because I'm so much faster than a normal human being that I tried to hold onto the motor. Even as my hands touched it, I was thinking, it's going to be loads of fun rowing with 10 burned fingers, so you can see I really was alert. It just didn't help. Neither did my sacrifice. We became wee, and then one terminal, wee, pollute, the motor left me. Followed a moment later with the exquisite subtlety of a Chuck Jones punchline by the barely audible whoosh of my cell phone leaving my shirt pocket and chasing the motor. It was suddenly much quieter. Just the white noise of the rain and the oscillating signal of the wind. I waited for the overgrown inner tube to start hissing, go soft, and sink, but fate's sense of humor was subtler than that. Lena was going to kill me. Worse, Keith was going to break my balls for the next 20 years. It wasn't fair. All she'd said was, "Don't sink my boat." Once the motor left the boat, it wasn't my responsibility. If it had asked me first, I'd have told it to stay. If you're going to burn all your fingers, it is useful to do so in a swimming pool with a decimeter or two of ice water in it. They didn't hurt too bad at all, until I picked the paddles up. Then they did. It was hard getting the paddles into those oarlock things. When I finally succeeded, I told myself I was an oarlock warlock, smiter Sherlock. Myself said it was sheer luck, so I called it a person from Porlock. A split personality suffering from Sherlock. When in danger, when in doubt, or run in circles, scream and shout, hey, look where you're going, look out where you're going. No, rowing is better in straight lines. Check position, assess wind and current, plot course, and row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Screw merrily, too many syllables. Row, row, row your boat. Row, row, row your boat. Fuck, fuck, fuck this boat. For about as many iterations as you used to be able to stand singing 99 bottles of beer on the school bus before your chest starts to hurt. Right side, low in back. Rest, get breath back. Pain fades reassuringly. Just a pulled muscle this time. Lift head, assess position and course. Yikes! So much for resting. Pick up paddles in sore hands and row, row, row your boat. Row your boat. Row your boat. Row your boat. Blow me boat. Row your boat. Chest pain comes much sooner this time, high and on the side. Sharp, too, but that's the good news. It's only one of the braces the surgeon's left in there, shifting around a bit, pinching some nerve. No biggie, usually. Work the right shoulder around, and it starts to back right off. Longer pause for recovery this time before you dare lift your head up, check position and course, and row, 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 row. Mild pain now, but it's dull and intimate. This summons some of the scariest memories you own. Even resting doesn't give you much of your breath back. One of the little bubbles you were born with on the bald tire that is your lung is officially threatening to let go. You remind yourself that sometimes the little bubbles are bluffing. And sometimes they pop, and they're just mini-collapses, of no consequences, a day or two in bed, moving carefully. The Charter of Rights and Freedoms must surely set some statutory upper limit on the amount of bad luck a man is allowed to have in any given day. Unclenched teeth, open eyes, and holy Jesus, it's not too much further. Let's row, 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 row. Okay, row, 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 row. Row, all right, damn it, row, 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 row. I had wondered all my life what the word landlubber was all about. I got it now. It came from a guy who was trying to tell the universe he was a landlubber and drowned before he could finish. Row, 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 row. Some tasks you can't ever complete, no matter how hard you try. But you have to keep on trying anyway. Die trying, if that's what it takes. You know what that's about, eh, Russell? Everything melted away. The pain, the fear, the boat, the sea and sky themselves, and I paddled through memory instead. Some of my least favorite memories, but I no longer had the strength to push them back. I was with Susan on one of her last good days. Don't ask how far our definition of good had contracted by that point, and don't even think about the days that came after that and redefined bad just as drastically. Lying beside my beloved wife in our last living room, on the fold-out couch my friends and I had converted to her deathbed. Her head on my chest, her left arm across my belly, carefully placed to avoid dislodging the IV. Talking quietly to me about some of the problems I would have to deal with after she died, advising me one last time. I'd done very few intelligent things in my entire life that weren't based on Susan's advice. She saved Jesse for last.
"Forget it, Russell. He's got a perfectly good brain. There has to be some way."
She shook her head against my chest. "Spice, listen to me. I'm not saying you won't be able to do it. I'm saying it isn't going to be doable by you or the best shrink in the world or anybody." "But it's so stupid." "That's not a word that applies in this context. It's like saying apples are awkward." "But it's sad, yes. That won't be easy to take. But it's nobody's fault. Not yours, not his. It's just the way it is. Who Jesse is, the age he happens to be now, who you are, how he relates to you and to me and to this. All the history between all of us so far. Suppose I, no matter what you say or do, no matter how rational he is on most other subjects, Jesse is going to hold you responsible for me being gone. He is going to believe, no, he is going to know for a fact that you could have talked me out of it if you really wanted to, that your voice added to his would unquestionably have turned the tide. Ergo, you must not have really wanted to. Ergo, you are evil. You are merciless, indifferent, selfish. You are the cancer itself. It will take him years to get past that. It's just who he is and who he imagines you are." I didn't answer. I knew she was probably right. "That's a shame, because you don't deserve his anger, and trust me, he's going to feel like a major jerk about it one day. But I can live with... no, I can die with the thought of him hating his dad's guts for a few years. He'll move as far away from you as possible. Don't be surprised if he actually picks New York, just to spite you. And that'll actually be a good thing. I think you both need to be alone for a while, to heal separately before you try to heal together. Does that make any sense?"
"I guess. I'm not sure."
"But what I can't die with is the thought of you hating him back. Of you doing just what he's doing, being mad at him for something he can't help. You're supposed to be smarter than a 21-year-old. If you let yourself stay pissed off at him, together you're going to both dig yourselves a hole you'll be too stubborn to climb out of even when you finally figure out you should." I sighed. "Damn it, babe, I've been letting him be pissed off at me since he was 16. "Sure, that comes with the job. That's the point. He's about to become 10 times as pissed off as ever, and you're his customary whipping man."
"Terrific. What am I supposed to do with my own rage against the universe for stealing you?"
She reached up, being careful of the IV, and touched my face. "Put it to good use. Sit down at your keyboard and aim it at all the sons of bitches and bitches in the world. Right livelihood, the Buddhists call it. Cut 'em all a new one for me."
Pain, with its reminder of mortality, brought me back to myself. I learned a long time ago that I can die. Being reminded wasn't even interesting. I was absolutely unsurprised to be unready again this time. I kept rowing because now it was easier to keep going than to stop somehow. Row, 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 maybe not. Row, 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 row. Noise asserted itself. Noises. Ugly noises. Death rattle thunder. Giant turds falling into a bowl from a great height. Whiplashes. Lions roaring. Birds shrieking. God trying to shush them all. This was some very groovy acid. Maybe I should stop a minute and dig it, smell the fish, open my eyes, the visuals might be even better. Holy shit, I was nearly there. Now what? I had a very short list of contingency plans for this. Always go with your best hope first. At least it didn't call for physical exertion. I closed my eyes again and thought as hard as I could, so hard that I saw bursts of acid colors again, saw them shape the words I was thinking in shimmering blossoms of fire, heard my voice chant them in my head louder than all the Gyuto monks in Dharamsala. "Help me, Zooty! Help me, Zooty! Help me, Zooty!" It's a hell of a note when your best hope is something you don't think is going to work. Xander Zuniga had told me a few years ago, the first night I'd seen him since we'd been college roommates back in the 60s, that these days he had to stay at least 100 meters away from people, or it was agony. If you're an American baffled by the metric system, nobody else is, a meter is about a yard. From anyone but me, anyway, apparently I don't think as loud as most people or something. That was my sole data point for his current telepathic sensitivity. With absolutely nothing to go on but intuition, always a poor guide in novel circumstances, it felt to me like if 100 meters was safe range, anything over 500 meters would be out of range altogether. I was a good 300 feet from the catastrophe zone where sea and land met snarling, itself a good 100 meters across, and beyond that were 50 meters of horrible, rocky, rising shore before you even came to the edge of the twisted, deformed but quite thick woods. God alone knew whether Zooty's home even lay on this side of the island. There was no guarantee he had not gone to the mainland for a quart of milk today. There was no guarantee he was even still alive if it came to that. Hermiting is a risky profession. It had been more than 6 months since the last time I'd come out here to try calling him again, and, as always, gotten not an answer, but at least the sense that one was still being withheld.
"Help me, Zooty! Help me, Zooty! Xandor, please save my ass! Again!"
Okay, no problem. Go to plan B. Close my eyes, cross my fingers, arms and legs, head straight in, and pray to all the gods I didn't believe in that... Coming across the rocks of the shore like a ghost walrus, the cartoon character Baby Huey, or Tony Soprano if you prefer, bigger than life and stark naked... Holy shit! Reaching the surf line, beckoning me toward him with exaggerated gestures, indicating, "This way! This way! Right here, straight toward me! This way!" Well, hell, that had been my plan.
"Thanks, man. Here I come."
More gestures, all unmistakable.
"Not so loud. That's better. Keep coming."
"Sorry." I started paddling with all I had left.
"Keep coming. Keep coming. That's it. Straight in."
He had me heading into a rock funnel toward an unbroken line of exploding foam.
"Are you sure? It really looks..."
"Straight in." Giant, ragged boulders went by on either side. I was committed now, and everything ahead was ghastly.
"I trust you with my life, Zooty, but are you sure?"
"Straight in." One last huge black stone went by on my left, like the spine of a submerged whale or a submarine with no conning tower.
"Okay, but listen," I thought. "Some CIA or NSA spook is after you. Nika's cousin was..."
Suddenly he was gesturing even more frantically than I was paddling.
"Go left! Go left! Do it now! Go left!"
I went left, saw no point, kept going left. He gestured even harder. I gave it everything I had, and all at once saw a clear open channel to a tiny sand beach, maybe 6 or 7 meters wide, 2 or 3 long, even when the waves came all the way in, quite invisible to anyone who had not committed himself to certain death and then been directed just as I had.
"Thank you, Zooty!"
He came out waist deep to meet me. Help me beach the killer Zodiac. Help me out of it. Help me climb up onto and stretch out on a flattish bit of rock which was very hard and very cold, but not wet and not moving in any direction at all. Dragged the killer completely out of the water and up onto the rock that would not gut her, came and sat beside me. Familiar voice. The voice of the little Martian who keeps threatening bugs with his Illudium Q-36 explosive space modulator.
"You're okay now, Russell."
I felt like a crumb. "I'm sorry, man." He shrugged.
"I know what I look like naked. How close behind is he?" "Oh, hell, for a minute there I thought there was a problem or something." "Yeah, you too. We'll give her mine, too. Because this is my shower, you caught me bathing. Not that cold."
"I don't drink it, remember? No, not even tea." "Yes, dry and warmer than this."
Talking with Xandor can be unsettling for someone who doesn't smoke marijuana, but one compensation is it doesn't matter a bit if you're out of breath. You don't have to condense your own side of the conversation to the fewest possible gasped syllables and then take forever to get them out. So endeth Chapter 6 of Very Hard Choices, and that makes it time for another musical excerpt. It is the very last public performance ever of Frank Zappa, jamming with a gypsy jazz band in Budapest, where he'd been invited by the mayor. Frank knew a lot of people on June 30th, 1991. There'll be a couple of minutes of crowd noise and talk at the beginning, then it'll take Frank and the gypsy jazz band a while to agree on a key and tune up together and so forth. Then there'll be a little more than 10 minutes of some astonishing guitar that Frank improvises with a bunch of guys he's never met before, which he calls One of a Kind. He certainly could have named it after himself.
I would like to thank Mayor Dempsey for inviting me to Budapest.
Szeretném megköszönni a meghívást Budapestre.
I'm very happy to be here and to have a chance to play with my gypsy friends.
Boldog vagyok, hogy a cigány zenét barátaimmal együtt elénekelhetünk egy dalt.
The song we are going to play will be One of a Kind.
A dal, amit el fogunk énekelni, One of a Kind, egy kísérleti zene.
We will invent this song before your very eyes tonight. So, I will now tune my guitar and we'll get ready to play.
Felhangolom a gitáromat.